And now,
the definition. Definition.
Jordan Sheridan is here. Now, Jordan Sheridan is from the Status Coup. You know, he's a friend of the show. He's got a great show called The Status Coup. And he's here with us right now. Hey, Jordan, how are you?
Hey, Jimmy. Thanks for having me.
So now you're in Detroit, and you noticed. Tell me what you noticed, and then I'll show the video.
Sure. So CNN, to continue the CNN suck theme, they denied me credentials to get into the debate, to go into the spin room and interview people after and all that business. So we had access to the parking lot, and which was delightful. So essentially, they allowed us into the parking lot. So we had basically access to where the candidate supporters were. They call it the visibility zone. And it's basically when CNN cuts to commercial, goes out of commercial, they zoom in on the candidate supporters, waving signs and all that. So if you watch CNN yesterday, it looked like Elizabeth Warren has this force, all Warren signs, and you barely saw any Bernie Sanders supporters. And what I learned later when multiple Bernie Sanders supporters approached me was the police were literally blocking Bernie Sanders supporters from entering this area where candidate supporters wave their signs. Police were allowing Elizabeth Warren supporters to freely enter, Joe Biden supporters to freely enter, Marianne Williamson supporters to freely enter. And when Bernie Sanders supporters tried to come in wearing their Bernie shirts with signs, they were told they can't enter. In many cases, I was told they were sent on wild goose chases. Go to that corner, which was barricaded. Several people were told you can't bring in signs that large, but they allowed Elizabeth Warren's supporters to bring in mega signs. So in addition to blocking Bernie Sanders supporters from coming in, the Bernie Sanders supporters that were there, if you look at the footage, which we went through, CNN's camera was very obviously panning. They're zooming in on Warren supporters with the big signs that they allowed Warren supporters to come in with. Then they're showing the three Biden supporters, because there were literally like three or four Biden supporters. And then in the corner, you see like one or two Bernie signs, and they zoom out right away and show this mega CNN logo. They basically parked the Bernie supporters behind a CNN logo so you couldn't see them.
So
the footage clearly shows it.
Go ahead.
What's incredible about it, there was a Green New Deal march with a lot of these Sunrise Movement people, Ocasio-Cortez supporters, but the majority of them were Bernie supporters. Ty, my cameraman and producer, covered it. And they were marching down to try and get into this zone. So the Bernie supporters far outweighed the Warren supporters, but literally the police were letting in every supporters of every other candidate but Bernie. And when Bernie supporters that I spoke to told me that when they pushed back against police saying, no, we were told by the campaign to come, look, I have the email, they were told, take it up with CNN, meaning the cops were following what CNN was telling them. And this isn't surprising to me, because in Miami for the first Democratic debate, I was down there. Again, they didn't approve us for credentials, but a security guard came up to me because they weren't letting me go in and interview any of these supporters. And he thought I was mad at him, so he came up to me off camera and said, he was very apologetic. He said, hey, sorry, I'm just following what, the party told me, the DNC, not to let, I don't know if it was just me or other journalists in. So basically they have these human beings, Biden supporters, Buttigieg supporters, this was in Miami, as standing props and mannequins, but they won't let you go interview them. In 2016, I was able to interview them. So the security guard was telling me it was the network and the DNC instructing them, don't let any journalists in to talk to these people. And yesterday, the Bernie supporters, when they asked the police, why are all these other people allowed in with their huge signs and their shirts, we're not, they said, take it up with CNN. And this is not surprising, because if you watch CNN yesterday, it was an alternate reality. They kept saying that Warren has surpassed Bernie in the polls, which is not factually
what?
Correct. It's not factually.
They were
correct.
Saying that on CNN.
Yes, they took one poll that shows Warren has been rising among very liberal voters and showed Bernie has been kind of flat, not telling the audience that very liberal voters are generally speaking traditional Democratic Party voters, specifically older voters. That's That's how those kinds of voters are classified in these polls. But they use that one poll to basically make it seem like Bernie's lost his mojo, Bernie has fallen behind Warren. And I tweeted this out literally yesterday. Three polls came out, three different polls, with Bernie in a very solid second place. And CNN is putting this stuff out there that Warren has surpassed Bernie. And I think if you look at the footage, it goes a little bit beyond just kind of like CNN PR. What they're doing is kind of what political campaigns do, you know, showing what you want to do, showing what you want to accentuate, blocking out what you don't. So I don't know how any objective person, whether you're Bernie supporter, Warren supporter, neither, can look at that and think this network is giving Bernie Sanders a fair shot. And you already covered. I mean, Jake Tapper was literally doing talking points where he's put, you know, it's this narrative, and MSNBC did it in the first question to Bernie too. You're going to raise taxes in the middle class. Of course, there's zero context that overall costs will go down. So to me, CNN revealed itself as, you know, the corporate public relations propaganda stooge that they are. But these are the kind of stories that happened at the Philadelphia DNC, where Bernie Sanders delegates were kicked out and basically treated like the scum at the bottom of your shoe. And these are the kinds of things happening that aren't getting any news coverage. The subtle and not so subtle blocking of Bernie Sanders supporters that the DNC and the news networks, they're going to come later if Biden is the nominee and say, well, why won't those Bernie people come home to the Democratic Party? Maybe because of like this.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's your brother, my man, Deez. Welcome to this episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Oh, you know, something is quite interesting. I'm going to start this off on a very, maybe personal level, maybe. I don't know if I'd call it personal, but I expected to let the debates, if we can call them that, they're not really debates, but I expected to let the debates just kind of come and go without making any intense commentary on it, because I felt like if I did shows on the debates, specifically the debates, then they wouldn't date well. And what I mean by they wouldn't date well is just that whenever I produce an episode, I always try to foresee how that episode is going to look 5 to 10 years out. Is it going to be valuable 5 to 10 years out? And the reason I do this isn't because of some egotistical need to be, you know, liked 5 or 10 years out. It is because oftentimes when people do media content, when they produce media content, they aren't looking at the vision that they are creating. They just look at the immediate gratification that they may feel or the immediate impact that they may achieve by producing that media content. I have become much more, and maybe this is because of how late I started evolving with this mentality, but I've become much more conscious of the idea of words, actions, deeds, and the visionary future. It also may come from the fact that, unlike many of the people who are doing media content, I went to school for business. I only went for a couple of years, but I was intrigued enough with what I studied for 2 years that I kept studying when I was done. And one of the primary premises that businesses implement, especially when you get to what's called the executive level or the planning level, over the last 30 or 40 years, they have begun implementing something called visionary strategy, which it's called various things depending on which industry you look at, which company you're looking at, what business model they're using. But there's something called visionary strategy. And visionary strategy used to really just be simply looking at buying and selling trends for the next 10 to 20, sometimes 25 years. And then trying to match what you are going to be producing or offering according to those trends. But increasingly, visionary strategy, especially as we are moving into a society which is trying to become much more conscious of its impact on the community, the environment, and the future, it increasingly surrounds the impact of not only the business cycle, but your response to the business cycle, and ultimately what you are producing for that business cycle. And so, I mean, this is something that is in its nascent beginning, but it is something that I see, especially a lot of people under the age of 30 and under the age of 25 starting to wrap their minds around. Now, it's kind of ironic because I'm also somewhat a little bit into astrology, and Uranus, or Uranus, which is, of course, as you know, one of the outer planets, typically has this visionary quality. And the reason why I bring that up is because whenever you want to see the extended forecast when you're looking at your astrology, always look at Uranus. Always. Always go into Uranus, go into Neptune, and then Pluto. But Pluto is like your reincarnation planet, so most people don't even ever bother with that. But this visionary strategy that I really learned about in 2010 and 11 has really kept my mind focused on the target. And that is, among other things, creating the mindset ripe for revision. Now, we are often told about the word revision, that it just means to change something that may be distasteful, maybe not acceptable, things like that. But, in fact, revision is literally revision. So I think oftentimes we utilize it incorrectly, but, you know, this is English, and in English you use most words incorrectly. The mind has to be ripe for revision because you have to literally have in your mind a vision for the society. And the vision that we often have in our minds for the society is built on mythology. In other words, what we were taught as children, the myth that we were taught as children, is incorrect. We have built a society on the mythology that we learned as children, that is completely incorrect. The origins of this country, why this country was quote, settled in the first place as colonies, all of that is incorrect. All of it is incorrect. We don't even often admit why the colonists were so eager to, quote, leave England and quote, settle here. We don't often admit, as a friend of mine who has been, for some odd reason, because he likes it, I guess, in his spare time, reading through the early governors' histories. And as he admitted, and I don't know truthfully how true this is. I've seen evidence suggesting that he's correct, but I've also seen evidence suggesting that not so much. But he said that when the first, quote, settlers, the first colonists arrived here, they treated the Native Americans pretty good. It was only after the elite showed up, basically, that things got real and the Native Americans started getting kind of screwed over. And this makes a little bit of sense because that's kind of how European culture and history happens. The people at the lower end of the society are actually pretty nice and decent people and very egalitarian. But then you get the middle manager types who come in and start, you know, ordering them around and saying, you know, screw the sympathy stuff. We need to capture and conquer this land so we can make money off of it. It's kind of the same mentality that goes into corporations and companies. So you can see that type of thing. But that is a part of the myth that we don't even talk about. I mean, imagine if that is 100% true. And you start teaching young people, you start teaching kindergartners, that if it had not been for middle managers and upper management, basically, specifically the British society, the Spanish society was, you know, that's a different story. They came looking for a fight. But if it wasn't for the middle and upper management in the British society, you may have not had this tremendous slaughter of the Native Americans. There could have actually been a peaceful coexistence, and the people could have lived harmoniously together. Granted, I think the English persons would have ended up integrating in with the Native Americans. But imagine if you taught, I mean, that is a incredible history lesson. That is an incredible class consciousness lesson that we often don't get to hear. That way, way back, assuming it's true, the people who came over here, many of which died, by the way, because they were so ill-prepared to deal with the climate, and they were literally digging for gold when they should have been preparing for the winters. To be fair, Britain doesn't get the kind of winters that we do, but, and I live in the Northeast, so trust me when I tell you, we get some winters up here. But they were then helped out by the Native Americans, who they treated very, very well. And then suddenly, here comes these middle management people, kind of like middle managers in business. And they were like, screw your sensitivities, screw how you know, any agreements that you've made, blah, blah, blah. We need to make money, so we will kill and murder and maim anyone we gotta. I mean, that changes your whole perspective of the corporation. And it also changes your whole perspective of who the problem in the society is, wouldn't it? Yes, it would. But so, these mythologies have created a horrible society that can't even look at itself in the mirror. With this in my mind, also because at the time I happened to be studying Dr. King and was very fascinated on his continued reliance on looking ahead to the future, creating for the future. Everything he was doing was about setting up structures for the future and maintaining those structures in the future, which I hadn't heard anybody up to that point talking the way that Dr. King talked about using strategies to specifically implement a new vision for the future. And he was very, very good at that. So all of this kind of came together for me. And when I started producing these episodes, I wanted my episodes to be futuristic in that aspect. And so looking at this year's debates, I couldn't possibly see how those debates would be relevant in 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 10 years. In fact, I was pretty confident that after 2 years, maybe even four, maybe they'd still be relevant in 2 years, but maybe after 4 years, those debates would be trash. But a couple of things have happened which makes me believe that these debates are a turning point. The first thing that has happened, and you heard a little bit of it at the beginning of the episode, is the corporate media has made it very, very clear that they are part, well, I said corporate media. So they've made it very, very clear that they are part of the establishment and that they are now pushing establishment propaganda, and they are willing to push establishment propaganda, which is, I know this. But I happen to be listening to two very important contributors to my thinking presently. The first one is this book, which I believe it was Chris Hedges who suggested it. This book titled Friendly Fascism. And Friendly Fascism is an interesting book because it was written in the late 70s, and then it was revised during the early 80s, so Reagan's first term. And it was written about power and about the changing dynamics of the power of the times. The book, in and of itself, is so fascinating because it gives you a glimpse of the power source of the society and then proceeds to give you an idea as to why that power source would move very deliberately towards fascism and what that fascism might look like in a country such as America. There was one specific part in that book that I happened to listen to a couple of weeks ago, and I'm listening to it while I'm at work. And it was what I titled, anyway, The Fight Against a Truly Progressive or Radical Leftist. I think he's used the word leftist. And I mean the real leftist, not, you know, progressives, in many instances, are pretty good on social issues, but they are conservative on a lot of other issues. But this guy, the author, was talking about the fight against and how they might immobilize a truly leftist president. Now, some of the suggestions that he made in the book are obviously dated. They don't apply to today. Some of them, somewhat kind of close to it. He talks about détente with the USSR and enforcing détente, and it almost reminds me of what's happening with Russia. But he also talks about, you know, things that have to do with unionization, protesting, things like that, and how unpopular that would be, and how they might try to stop that type of a person from ascending to the presidency, or even limit their ability to do anything once they get to the presidency. Now, when I found this this portion of the book, when I was listening to it, I immediately started thinking about Bernie Sanders. But I also started thinking about, in the state which I live, New York, we once had a governor named Elliot Spitzer. Now, everyone knows about Spitzer and his, you know, liking to be with prostitutes. Who cares? I don't. But when you read that section of the book, and then you look at client number 6 or 9, I can't remember the name of the documentary, but you look at the documentary on what happened to Elliot Spitzer, it fits. And I've always argued that they took Elliot Spitzer down because he was a truly progressive and a truly leftist governor. And they couldn't have that. So now we have Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders, to his credit, is very leftist on many, many, many more instances than he's not. But it is undeniable to me that they, the wealthy, are scared of Bernie Sanders. And the question that I've always had is, how far will they go to stop him or to delegitimize him so he doesn't progress farther and become the president of the United States? Or, in their minds, God forbid, he becomes president. What will they do to try to limit his capabilities of doing anything? This is where the debates come in. This is where the debates come in. My old friend Jimmy Dore, I don't really know the guy, but I do typically like his content and his material, so I count him as a friend or a brother. A couple of days after the last debate, or maybe the day after the last debate, he produced a very interesting video about CNN's treatment of Bernie Sanders supporters at the debate. And in this video, he talks to a guy named Jordan Sheridan. Now, I gotta be honest, family. I watch his show too. He has a YouTube show called Status Coup, COUP. And so I know him. What is funny is I only know him as Jordan from Status Coup. So I literally had to look up his name because, you know, I didn't know. But Jordan Sheridan. And he's actually a journalist. He does journalist work. And you could tell by how he dissects information that he is really good at amassing information, dissecting it, and then putting it out for your ingestion. So you can actually understand what's going on. He was at the debates. Jordan Sheridan was at the debates. And I knew when I heard they were putting Elizabeth Warren next to Bernie Sanders, I knew what this was about. I knew that it was an attempt, a blatant attempt, to liken Elizabeth Warren to Bernie Sanders. Now, Cenk Uygur, our old friend Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks, has been pushing this concept for a long time, that the two of them are basically peas in a pod. They're, you know, you can't tell one from the other, which is absolutely, utterly false. And I'm trying not to get off on the Cenk Uygur thing because there's some theories that are emerging in my mind about Cenk Uygur, but I'm going to leave those to another day, or at least until I can move a couple of them to fact. But he's been pushing this, and this has been something that places like The Hill has also seemed to be pushing, and, or should I say, maybe he's been pushing it for them, but some of their questioning makes me kind of think that they're falling in line with that, too. I've seen this on multiple sites on the internet. So I knew that this was a trick of the eye, because, you know, you always have to remember that there is whenever the media is involved, there's always illusion. They're always moving you to a position which they want you to be at, which should tell you that the media was not against Donald Trump. They were not against Donald Trump. Anyway, they had Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth standing next to each other, and this was a trick of the eye to make you think that they were similar. Then if you watched the debate, I did not, I was working, you would have seen that there were all of these Warren supporters holding up big signs, and very few Bernie Sanders supporters. What Jordan Sheraton told Jimmy Dore's audience, and the fact that this thing only has, at the time when I'm speaking about it, just under 85,000 hits, is impossible. This is when I'm looking at YouTube and saying, yeah, there's something fishy going on. We could talk about Tulsi Gabbard suing Google, which is also massively important, too, because they were, they closed out her ad account after the last debate, which she was the most talked about candidate out of there. All of this is going to be impacting the future family. So, they had, what Jordan Sheraton had seen while at the debate was that Bernie Sanders supporters, listen to what I'm, people talk about conspiracy theorists, such a negative phraseology. You're crazy if you're a conspiracy theorist. You are a tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorist. I'm about to tell you of a conspiracy, peoples. I'm not joking. Because what he described is multiple level conspiring to ensure that Bernie Sanders supporters would not be seen by a national audience. Watch your eyes. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are standing next to each other. They're similar. But yet, all you're seeing is Elizabeth Warren's supporters outside when the cameras pan. So what he said, and I think I'm going to play a clip of this in a few seconds. What he said was that Bernie Sanders supporters were being misled by the police. Security, which it might have just been CNN security, might have not been police officers, but it sounds like there is police officers directing things there, which is why I say this is a top-down conspiracy. This goes from one level to the other. They were removing Bernie Sanders supporters, basically, from the key areas which would be shown by the cameras. They were misdirecting them, sometimes to dead ends, as Mr. Sheraton was talking about, and you'll hear him say. And sometimes, or excuse me, not sometimes, but all the times, they were putting them in this place where they would be covered up by a CNN logo. Now, why is this important? First, you're going to hear him talk about this. And I'm going to play that in a second. But I really want to explain why this is important, because we are in a time period where we are being told that the media is anti-Trump. The media is on the side of the average person. The media should be trusted. Now, when Trump came out and started calling the media fake news, I did a podcast where I started talking about how the media has been utilized by the CIA and the military to lie to the public. And that most people know this. And that's why they're so susceptible to Donald Trump saying the media is fake news. What was shown on this debate stage, and what was shown in this debate atmosphere, because it includes what was happening outside, the fact that they didn't allow Mike Gravel, who actually qualified for the debate, to take the stage, because he didn't fit into the narrative that they were pushing. He didn't fit into the narrative that they were pushing, so they had to exclude him. But the fact that this all happened is telling you, one, that the media, and I said it earlier, is complicit in deceiving the society. The media is complicit in deceiving society. Donald Trump isn't wrong about that. And that's tragic that I have to say that. This also tells you, a little bit of looking backwards now, that what Hillary Clinton said in 2008 was correct. The media was biased towards Barack Obama. They were. It's time to admit that. And the question is why, but I ain't going to get into that. For the future, this has stark implications. Why? Because presently, we are experiencing a generational transition away from your traditional media sources. CBS News, for the first time ever, has a digital platform. I mean, I think it's been around for a year or so, but it's making its footprint felt on YouTube. Now, YouTube just recently was caught. They were caught by investigative journalists changing their algorithms to force mainstream media videos onto people on YouTube. They were just recently caught and called out for doing that. Now, I noticed this actually way back after the 2018 midterms were over. That suddenly, if I watched Jimmy Dore prior to that time period, I would get a lot of Jimmy Dore, or I'd get Status Quo, or I'd get similar videos. Well, after the 2018 midterm, which was undeniably fueled by alternative media, suddenly I realized when I was watching Jimmy Dore, I'd get Fox News, I'd get CNN, I'd get MSNBC, I'd get CBSN, which is CBS News, which is how I found out that CBS News actually had a footprint on YouTube. I would get Bloomberg's TikTok, which, you know, I didn't even know that existed. I would get affiliates out of Washington, out of Detroit, all over the place. But I would not get more Jimmy Dore or Status Quo. It was finally revealed that they were doing this, and lo and behold, it stopped. The media, along with tech companies, basically all the instruments of corporate power, are trying to rework society again to move it away from what it most needs, which is dramatic left-wing revision. And by them excluding the Bernie Sanders supporters and putting up Warren, what it's telling you is that Warren is their choice. Because look, Biden isn't going to get it. the internal polling, I want you to understand, when you're looking at the polls, quote-unquote, that the media keeps quoting from, these are mostly manufactured polls. What I mean by manufactured polls isn't that they're creating them out of thin air, even though sometimes I wonder if they're just creating them out of thin air. But what most polls are samplings. And if you find the right location in the country, you can get it to say anything. They're not polling regular people. Most of the time, they're polling what they call middle-class people. And these middle-class people aren't like you and I. Okay, some of you are probably like them, but they're not like me. Okay? A couple of years ago, I finally got a job that I was making $30,000 at. Now, to give you an idea of why that's important, because I'm almost 40. In my lifetime, that is the first job that I've had where I was making over $30,000. And there's a lot of other people like me who are living every day. They're not talking to us. They're talking to people who are making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 per person. And if you talk to those people, you're going to get more moderate answers. You're going to get more mainstream, as they might say, answers. Those are the type of people that they're going to go after. And if you go after the right community, you can get any type of arrangement of the candidates that you want. All you have to do is just know where to look. However, the Democratic Party also does more extensive internal polling. And the internal polling isn't as restricted in its sampling as the ones which they use for the public consumption. And I learned this because a couple of years ago, after the election in 2016, I went on to a couple of websites that offer polling services, and they offer polling data analyses. And I checked out a couple of their packages, and even somewhat utilized one of them. It was a lower level one, but it was still one of them. And realized just how detailed these packages were. And I also realized just how much money went into polling. And what those polls, if you did them extensively enough, could actually show you. In the Democratic Party, they not only have polling for each state, but they have polling for each district, congressional district, and sometimes even polls that are more specific to regions or counties. And some counties are more important than others. And so what their internal polling is showing, they ain't telling you this. What their internal polling is showing is that Bernie Sanders is ahead. Not Joe Biden, not Kamala Harris, not Elizabeth Warren. No. Their internal polling is telling them, that Bernie Sanders is ahead. Just as it did in 2016. Their internal polling is showing them that Bernie Sanders is not only ahead, but he is ahead by leaps and bounds. His closest rival is Elizabeth Warren. That's why you saw them put together. If his closest rival was Kamala Harris, then they would have put her right next to him. If his closest rival was Beto O'Rourke, you see where I'm going with this. If it was Joe Biden, they'd probably put them on the same stage, but opposite wings. They might even put him next to him. But it isn't. They know that Joe Biden isn't catching fire, and they know that he's not going to win. One of the reasons they know this is because of, you know, black vote. He's not going to get a significant amount of the black vote. Even with his time spent as Obama's second in command. Now, this is important for the future. Because I mentioned that I was, you know, to kind of jump back a little bit, I mentioned that two things were influencing my current thinking. The first one I mentioned was Friendly Fascism, the book. The second one I have not mentioned yet. A good podcast that I like to listen to frequently, I've been listening to it since 2008, is called The Best of the Left Podcast. It's changed a lot over the last 4 or 5 years, but it's still a very good podcast. And back in, I think it was 2010, a caller called in on their listener line and informed the listeners of this great podcast, which is no longer being produced, called Hardcore History. And particularly, a series that they were doing on the decline of the Roman Republic. I immediately went to Hardcore History and downloaded all of those episodes and started listening to them. Now, I'll be honest with you. I liked the podcasts when I first heard them, but I wasn't enthralled with them. I wasn't enthralled with them. I knew they were important, but I wasn't enthralled with them. I listened to them a few times, and then just, you know, they sat on my hard drive. In 2018, when I was home sick with the flu, first time ever in my life, by the way, first time ever, I was recovering and needed something to listen to and found those podcasts. First time in 5 years had laid eyes on them and started listening to them. Yeah, still not too enthralled. I was too sick. Couldn't really get into them. This past year, 2018, I listened to them again and knew there was something special about them. I've been listening to them a few times a month for the last 3 months. And what is very evident is part of what was happening to the Roman Republic is definitely happening now. Especially when you look at the idea of the reformers that were being dealt with and how they were being dealt with. You see some of that presently. You see some of that presently. And it is very clear from what happened with the Bernie Sanders supporters that the media is going to be complicit in, I'm not going to say preventing, but maybe stymieing any true reform. And that is problematic because reform is needed, dramatically needed. And so what you are seeing now is an outgrowth of tactics which had been sparingly utilized in the past, hardening to extreme utilization. So that, you know, before they had plausible deniability because they could say, look, if we were really trying to stop this, then, you know, it would be more upfront. But now, because of the nature of the emergency that they perceive, they are deploying these strategies in such a manner where it catches the eye. It catches the eye.
So I'm going to play another clip from that wonderful exchange between Jordan Sheraton and Jimmy Dore. And then I'm going to come back. I was going to actually play a clip from the wonderful Death Throes of Republic series done by Dan Carlin. But I want to say, first and foremost, that earlier in the podcast, I mentioned that the cost was about $1.99, and I double-checked as I was in between recording sessions for this podcast. And I must say that the price has now increased to $9.99, which, truthfully, that's still a steal. It's well worth the $10. It is well worth the $10. The only thing that I've often said is that I wished Mr. Carlin would have been patient. You know, this is one of the truly, and I know it kind of sounds like I'm getting paid, but I'm not. This is one of the truly masterpiece constructions done by a person who is just passionately creating for the public. And so I wish he had been more patient with himself, and that he had given himself the opportunity, not even opportunity, I'm sorry, given himself the leeway to really tell the story. Because he mentioned at several points in the story that, you know, there was this and that and that and this that he could have spent more time on, because, you know, but it was kind of a side piece of what was actually going on. But I think it would have added to it. Plus, he admitted that the last five plus hour piece should have been 2 or 3 episodes. And he was right. It should have been. He ran through a lot of material very quickly to get to the end. And that's a shame, because I mean what I say. This is truthfully a dynamic piece of work, which would have only been added to if he had taken his time, given himself the leeway to really go through and to do the work that his heart, I think, wanted to do. He's obviously very passionate about the Roman Republic, and he knows a lot about it. That would have only added to the brilliance of the series. Moreover, me personally, I would have liked if he had followed the series a little bit more thoroughly into the period after Caesar, because that is really when you see the Republic get torn apart by the massive amounts of civil war. And even if he had spent a little bit more time, and, you know, people often tell me, well, why don't you do these things? Because that's not where my passion lies. But if he had even spent a little bit more time going through and talking about the social consequences, which he did a fabulous job, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not taking anything away from him on that. But particularly the social consequences as the civil wars intensified, that would have been a great help, especially presently. Of course, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. And who would have ever thought, Lord knows I didn't, in 2011, when I was listening to these podcasts, whoever would have thought that less than a decade later, I would be referencing them, because it would explain what was going on with us as a country. Nobody. So for his contribution to what I know, you know, I definitely tip my hat. That said, I'm going to play, as I started off saying, this clip from that exchange between Jordan Sheridan and Jimmy Dore, then come back with some commentary. Because there's more, ladies and gentlemen. There's much more. This is your brother, Vladimir Deese. I'll see you on the other side.
Jordan, they weren't allowing Bernie's supporters to have bigger signs. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Warren supporters, as you saw, were allowed, like, I think, 5x4 posters. And Bernie supporters weren't allowed to bring in their own signs. I guess they were provided signs.
Really?
And Biden supporters had bigger signs. Bernie supporters were not allowed to come in with Bernie shirts. I mean, this is, it's so transparently corrupt that, you know, you almost want to throw up your hands and laugh, because we're not surprised, but they're not even hiding it at this point. And I will tell you, Bernie Sanders' campaign didn't respond to me on the record. I think they were busy today, obviously. Somebody said, we took notice of this. So Bernie's campaign was seeing it, too. Somebody on Bernie's campaign said that to me, that we noticed. But, I mean, we've seen this for weeks, that they're propping up Warren. They're making it seem like, you know, Warren has a plan for everything where, you know, I like some of her plans, but in reality, a lot of her plans are recycled plans by Bernie Sanders that he's had for 20 years with a couple more paragraphs, you know. So she's not reinventing the wheel, but that is the narrative that you have seen from CNN, definitely MSNBC. But in this case, why this is so dangerous, not just because, you know, you're not a news outlet at this point, you're a propaganda arm. This is no different than what you'd expect from Fox News. But why this is dangerous is this is what is called an information war. It's no different than 2016, them throwing up the superdelegates on screen along with the pledge delegates to make it seem like Bernie's just totally, totally behind. He has no shot. Well, when you're showing this and it looks like Elizabeth Warren has all the momentum and all the mojo, and Bernie, look at that one sign in the corner, it has the potential of steeping in to some persuadable voters that are watching CNN to be like, oh, well, Bernie has no chance. You know, so that's what CNN is pushing. And I spoke with at least five or six Bernie supporters today, and they're saying basically like, this is 2016 all over again. It's no different, and we know how this ends. I would say that is dramatic, but I can't because I was in Miami and I saw what they were doing, where they were not letting journalists speak to the Bernie Sanders supporters or any of the supporters. And frankly, I mean, listen, Jimmy, I'm all for young journalists. They gave media credentials to a 10-year-old last night to interview Marianne Williamson and denied us credentials.
No, they don't have the 10-year-old.
Very cute, but give me a break.
They don't have to give you a real reason, right?
Space constraints, right?
So they can't let everybody in. We have to just let in some people who we think are important, and so they do not let you in.
10-year-olds to ask Marianne Williamson about her favorite pet. No offense to Marianne Williamson, I think she did a great job. But you know, I'm not going to knock anyone. But there are journalists that have far less of a following than Status Quo. They're being accepted in. You said in Miami, you know, there was enough space you could go golfing and it wouldn't hit anyone in that building. So it's all BS. I take it as a badge of honor because obviously that means that they know who we are and don't want adversarial journalists in there. But it's unfortunate, you know. Status Quo, and I know Jimmy Dore's show is not built on like access to the powerful. That's not why people watch us.
That would be the last thing this show's about: access to the powerful.
Right, but you know, at a certain point, isn't it good for the Democratic Party to have journalists challenge these politicians? Because if they do become the nominee, you don't think the Republicans are waiting with a 2x4? To ask Joe Biden, what did you mean when you told Wall Street, I'll fluff your pillows for 8 years? What did you mean when you called black people, those people in the 1990s, I don't want them near my mother with the crime bill? I mean, the ads write themselves. So, yes, totally shield all your corporate candidates, including For the People, Kamala Harris. No questioning. Ask them fluffy questions. I'm sure we'll get more of that tonight. And when you have Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on stage, go after Bernie hard, and then every other question you ask the corporate candidates is basically to have them attack Bernie.
Yes.
I mean, this is, you know, yes, Fox News is more racist and all that, but there's no difference right now when you're watching CNN and MSNBC from what Fox News did in the Obama years. I mean, it's very obvious, it's very deliberate, and it's unethical.
So I'm back, and you know, you heard the clip there. And hopefully you could see what I was talking about. Now, you know, I thought about another clip that I wanted to play, but I think I'm going to forego that because there is something else that I need to talk about when it comes to these debates, especially, you know, the last two presidential debates. You know, I can't speak for 2008. 2012 was a non-starter because I don't pay attention to the conservative presidential debates, mainly because they actually follow this pattern, but it is so much more easier to see with the Democrats because the conservative party, Republicans, as they're called, is already aligned themselves in a manner which makes what I'm about to say almost useless. In fact, it's because they were aligned heavily with corporations. And I don't say this because, you know, any conservative that is listening might say, well, you know, of course you're going to say that because you, you know, you're not a conservative. No. And I actually have an episode produced, which I will be publishing soon, which showcases where conservatism used to be and where it is presently and the insanity of where it is now compared to where it used to be and what it used to mean. No, I'm saying that because they keep advocating things which would benefit overwhelmingly corporations and not anybody else who's not a corporation. And many of the promises that these people have been making for the last 40 years, which they keep saying is just around the corner, hasn't materialized because they won't materialize. We've already done this before in the history of this country, and you either learn from your history or you're doomed to repeat it. And so I'm saying it because they keep advocating stuff that, you know, we've already done. It doesn't work, but we keep doing it nonetheless. So they're already aligned that way. The Democratic Party has moved that way in the last 30 years, but they haven't gotten there yet. The Democratic Party, unlike the Conservative Party, and really the Democratic Party for a long time could be called the Liberal Party, but they're not a Liberal Party anymore. The Democratic Party, unlike the Conservative Party, the Republican Party, they had to still, there was a narrative that was created in the late 50s for the Democratic Party, and this might have been Kennedy's doing. I don't know who's doing it, but they talked about a big tent party, and you've undoubtedly heard this. And the idea of the big tent party was that you'd have your Dixiecrats, who are segregationists and the like, mixed with your Northern liberals, mixed with your Midwestern Republican lights, and then your somewhat radicals. Mind you, I didn't mention progressive in there because they were a non-issue. But that's what the big tent was supposed to be about. And to try to cement the Dixiecrat position in the 1950s, the Democratic Party really kind of jerked and pushed off black people. And that's very important because it was the movement by the party, and this was definitely Kennedy's doing, towards civil rights when it was unavoidable. Because really, the country, we don't understand that the civil rights movement stopped this country from plunging into, or at least the South, some form of open combat, because the white population was acting so irresponsibly horrible to black people that there were many people advocating just, you know, to hell with these people. They take one of ours. We're going to take one of theirs. That's it. And truthfully, I can't blame them. You get tired of being nice and polite and kind to a people who keep beating you down. So I don't blame them for that. But there had to be something to release that tension. When the Democratic Party started going towards the civil rights, the Dixiecrats became pissed and switched over to the Republicans, and that's how it's been ever since. Now, in the 1970s, late 70s, into the 80s, there was a power struggle in the Democratic Party. And we all now know that the corporate wing started rising and moving into ascendancy. And so the Democratic Party, over the last 30 years, still talked about a big tent, still talked like it was a liberal party from the 1960s. And the Republican Party treated it like it was still from the 1960s, yet it wasn't that party. So over the last three, presidential cycles, and I'm not going to say elections, but cycles, because George Bush technically represented one election cycle. He shouldn't have won, but he did. Barack Obama represented the second cycle. And then the third one, obviously, is where we're at right now. But you have seen this kind of chessboard setup where in 2000, it was actually more of a competition. It was dramatically more competitive. But people kind of knew that it was setting the table for Al Gore to run as president. So it wasn't surprising when he came out on top. In 2008, it was more competitive because you actually had viable candidates. You had Edwards, you had Clinton, and nobody really expected Obama to win. That's the funny part. Like, Obama was there. He was an up-and-coming star. He was expected to lose, but then he'd probably win in 2016. You know, this was Clinton or Edwards here. It was going to be Edward, who was the anti-establishment candidate, and Clinton, who was the kind of establishment candidate who was setting the tone of the campaign. And then Barack Obama just came out of nowhere, and I've made this statement before that, you know, it's very clear to me now that all of this was done not just to shirk Clinton, but the establishment was terrified of Edward. They were terrified of Edward. So they had to figure something out, and that's where Obama came in. But you could see this chessboard setting up to make the queen or the king ascendancy to the throne, as it was. But really, you know, it's not really the throne, but to the executive office, that it can make it possible for them. The only difference was in 2008, you didn't exactly know where the chips were going to fall. So there was a lot of underhanded stuff going on. And if you remember the election, you remember there was a lot of underhanded stuff going on. Some of it from Clinton's camp. Looking back, the media was undoubtedly on Obama's side. I mean, most black people don't like to admit this. I didn't even like to admit it. I thought it was absolutely nuts back then. But looking back on it, I'm saying, oh yeah, the media was absolutely on his side. Holy wow. And they were doing everything they could to decrease the visibility of Edward. Now, I'm guaranteeing there was at least one other person that was running who they were also screwing, but I can't remember who it was. But this was the first time you really had this problem with, okay, the establishment wants this person, or so it seemed. Looking back on it, family, I'm going to tell you, the establishment wanted Obama. They wanted Obama. But, and the people want this person. The people, up until Obama entered the race, were really on Edward's side. And that must be very well stated. Anyway, moving beyond that cycle to 2016. If you looked at the field who was running, what you saw was a field, a board, that was set up to highlight Clinton and to push Clinton. I mean, there was literally no youth running against her on that stage. Nothing. There was no threat of her being beat, and then here comes Bernie Sanders. Now, what is probably the most interesting part of 2016 is how brazen it was. And this is important as we go forward, because I've made a mention in other episodes that the Democratic Party, the elite, if you would, they've been doing this incredible amount of polling. They always poll. Noam Chomsky said this back in the 80s and the 90s, that they're polling to understand the country's mood, and then they utilize that information to push whatever agenda it is that they want to push, not what we want. But they've been polling for the last 20 plus years, and specifically, they're really interested in the new, what they call new generation. So every 20 years you get kind of this swing in the generational force. And sometimes it takes 25 years, but you get a swing in the generational force, and they're interested in seeing where that swing is going to take them and how they have to, how they should counter it. So in 2000, 1999, 1998, 1997, 2001, 2002, 2003, but 2000 was specifically targeted. They realized that the country was moving dramatically to the left. They realized that it was moving dramatically to the left. So what do you do with that? Well, you could either give in to where the country's going, or you can counter it. And the moves, if you look at all the presidential elections since 2000, it has been to push the country to the right or to make it stay wherever it was at. Barack Obama is the clear exception. They wanted to move the country to the right after Bush, but it was unfeasible because people were pissed. So they just want, just hold the status quo. Don't move anywhere. Hold the status quo, Obama. That's all you got to do. Now, I know some people will say, well, you know, I believe he moved it to the right. Barack Obama was supposed to hold the status quo. Yeah, he signed some stuff into law, but he didn't, he did not move it like Bush did. He didn't move it like Reagan did. And even Bush 1 tried to recenter it. He even tried to do some stuff to, you know, push it a little bit so it wouldn't go too far right. Clinton initially tried to push left, got a lot of heat for it, including from the media. People forget that. And so he had to amend what he was doing. Anyway, though, so what you were seeing in this specific election leading up to 2020, because this is another banner year. Like I said, every 20 years, there seems to be a generational push. Now, it sometimes doesn't manifest until after 25 years. So, if it wasn't for September 11th, this country was going to have a dramatically different election cycle, which would have continued in 2002 and then in 2004. If it was not for September 11th, that literally changed the course of history. And what I like to what I tend to say is it changed the course of the energy in this country. September 11th really changed the mental energies in this country dramatically. And we are now at the end of its impact. So that's why you're seeing this moving, I suppose, back to the left-wing politic, because you have a generation which was just graduating from high school in 2000 and around 2000 who was unable to express itself fully. Now, 18 to 54, there's a reason why marketers look at those ages, and particularly that age range, because you had, that's kind of your, you know, if 18 is spring, okay, 54, maybe even 60, but yeah, they'll say 54. That's the beginning of your autumn. So that's when your influence is more at home, domestic, you're inputting all the information that you gained from your life into the next generation and all that. The people who graduated in 2000, well, I'll go from 97 to 2003. These people are right there in the middle of that age range. We'll go 18 to 60. They're right in the middle of that age range, meaning they're in the summer of their lives. They have a vision, and even if they don't understand the vision, they have it, and they want to make sure that it is in place so the next generation would be set up well. it's a powerful realization when you understand the metaphysics of it all. What is occurring, though, is the status quo, who is drunk off of the money that they have been able to extract from this society. And I mean that. They are drunk off of the money that they've been able to extract from this society. They don't want to share any of it, even though it's going to save the society, because right now the society is in horrible shape. They don't want to do what is necessary to maintain the social structures. They'd rather keep making their money and dealing with the consequences as they pass over them. Again, I maybe I'm able to see this now because I'm literally listening to this Roman Republic Decline podcast, and the similarities is just, it's mind-blowing and stunning. We are seeing, and this is going to become very, very much more noticeable as we move into the third, as it was, debate. Because presently, 7 of the 20 candidates have passed the threshold to make the next debate. And it's kind of interesting to see who they all are. All but 2 of them are really corporate shills. And I mean that in the most nicest way possible. I really don't. All but 2 of them really are corporate shills. And even one of the 2 that, you know, I'm asked to reserve as non-corporate shills, kind of smells like they're going to be corporate shilling if they were to get elected. The list includes 1 Bernie Sanders, obviously. The list, though, includes, and this is why I say corporate shills, and I in the recent Democratic debate, you saw them place Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren by each other. And I actually have a theory about that. They are trying to push Warren as the alternative, the safe alternative to Bernie Sanders. That she is Bernie Sanders light. She's going to do everything Bernie's going to do, except she's conservative enough for the country to you know, accept, because she's not going to really do everything Bernie Sanders is going to do. Now, I want you to understand this, family. I really don't know if Bernie Sanders wants to be president. I really don't know if Bernie Sanders wants to be president. I think we have to do a lot of soul searching when it comes to some of these politicians who we happen to like. And we have to understand that sometimes their original reason for being in or on the chessboard, the whole reason why Bernie Sanders was supposed to run in 2016 was to push Hillary Clinton to the left. To show how popular, this is my theory anyway, to show how popular those type of programs are, which would have then given Hillary Clinton the cover to do those things as president. Because unlike Barack Obama, and I know people hate me saying this, but unlike Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton actually does have leftist tendencies. And it is my sole belief that Hillary Clinton wanted Bernie Sanders to run for president with her. Not as a vice president, but to be on that stage, because it would again give her cover for doing the, quote, leftist things that she wanted to do as a president. I'm not saying that she hasn't done corporate-friendly things and that she wouldn't have done some corporate-friendly things. But as I keep saying, the elite aren't afraid of her. They're not afraid of her for nothing. They're not afraid of her for nothing. That said, I also wonder sometimes if Bernie Sanders himself entered into some kind of agreement with the Democratic Party that would enable him to not win the nomination and not make a big fuss of about it if the Democratic Party promises to implement a large portion of his wish list. And so the whole pushing of Elizabeth Warren is interesting in that way, because they are trying to pump her up as a natural ally for Bernie Sanders and also as a candidate alternative to Bernie Sanders. The rest of the field, like I said, corporate shills all, including the progressive darling, which tells you just how conservative-leaning many progressives are, because, you know, they so desperately sometimes want to be seen as non-racist that they don't listen to the people who are black and not voting for black people. They just, I don't know, they get lost or something. But the six people who have qualified, and I'm the first person that I'm going to highlight, which makes absolutely no sense except for the fact that he's a corporate shill, is Beto O'Rourke. How he even made it to the third debate is beyond me, but there he is. But he to me, is the epitome of the empty corporate shilling side of the Democratic Party. Of course, former Vice President Joe Biden, Cory Booker, who, you know, that's another one. Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who is he's another corporate shill. You know, he ex-military intelligence. He knows how to run a really good PSYOP operation. And when I look at a person like Pete Buttigieg, I see somebody who doesn't expect to win this. He's not in it to win it. It's the name recognition. I expect him to go on next to the Congress, maybe to the Senate, and then try his hand again maybe in 8 years. Kamala Harris. Now, again, I gotta underline this. Four of the last five people that I mentioned are hardcore corporatists. There's no question about it. And then finally, Amy Klobuchar. Now, Joseph Biden, and this is why it's important that we understand the chessboard family. Joseph Biden ain't going to be president. And to be honest with you, I think the establishment understands that he's not going to be president. It's not even a question. But now it's time to find somebody who can replace him, because without him, This is where Elizabeth Warren comes in. Without him, the establishment really has nobody who they believe can stand against Bernie Sanders. And the goal is to make sure Bernie Sanders doesn't get there. Again, I say I'm not sure if he wants to even get there himself. But Joseph Biden is falling. His star is falling. It's in decline. And so the question is, who's going to be able to step in to really take his position? And look, family, I got to tell you this, because there is a generational shift happening. And so you have youth, to some extent, on the stage. But none of it has the type of energy that is necessary, the bold, progressive, far-thinking energy that is necessary to carry the country forward in a direction that's going to help it. And this is how we have to start approaching these things. When we are looking, whether it's at president, whether it's at city council, whether it's county administrators, whether it's regional authorities, whether it's congressional races or Senate races, we have to start thinking, what is going to help this country move forward? Not just what do we want, because most of us get trapped in that. We hear free stuff and we say, okay, yay, that's good, let's do that. No, what's going to bring this country forward? What's going to bring this country forward, help it to become better? And that's a question I think we don't ask enough, nor do we ponder enough. Keep your eye on how this group shapes up, because there are two other people who are close. I'm hoping Tulsi Gabbard is one of them. Because Bernie Sanders really does need an ally up there. And if Gabbard doesn't make it, then, you know, you're going to see very clearly which way the winds are really blowing, because they're trying to exclude anybody who they deem too radical. And even though Tulsi is not 100% radical, they really don't. She is a natural ally to Bernie Sanders, and they need that alliance between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, so at the end they can set her up as the natural selection, not Bernie Sanders. So I'm looking at the New York Times presently, and two other candidates seem to be very close, and it doesn't surprise me that one of them is Julian Castro, another guy who he's corporate friendly to me. And then entrepreneur Andrew Yang has surpassed 130,000 donors. And each have three of the four qualifying polls they need. Tulsi Gabbard has crossed the 130,000 donor mark, her campaign said Friday, but she has only one qualifying poll so far. Now, I want you to also keep that in mind, because remember what I said about polls. You can make a poll say whatever the heck it is that you want. All you have to do is just find the right population. And so, as we move forward, family, first and foremost, let me advocate this, because this needs to be advocated. Go to Hardcore History. Type it in, Google it, Hardcore History, and find the fall or decline of the Roman Republic and download it. And listen to it. It's $2. It'll be the best $2 you ever spent on basically what is a very good audiobook. We have to now understand that these folks are against the type of reform that is necessary to help this country. And we are going to have to make it very clear to them that these reforms are needed to save whatever control it is that they think they have over this society. You have to understand how selfish most of these people are, and how absolutely enamored with cash they are. The only way that you speak to most of them is you make them realize that it's going to hurt them in the wallet. Pure and simple. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach me and my email address, which you can find on the posting at radioforall.net. This was a very fun episode to do. I enjoyed it. It took me a little bit longer than I wanted it to, but That's okay. I've been waiting for something to happen. For a week or a month or a year. Jackson Browne says that in the song that has ended each episode for several years now. I know what he means. Because you don't, until you really become conscious about your society and with your society, do you really understand that there is this waiting for something. Sometimes it's a war. Sometimes it's a revolution. Sometimes it's a healing. And sometimes you just don't know what it is. Until the next time I post another episode, family. I will see you. This is your brother, Brian Mary D's. Peace.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio talk shows and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.